Good afternoon. I will now call the meeting of Senate Resources to order. Let the record reflect it's 3:32 p.m. on Wednesday, March 30th, 2022. Let the record reflect we also have a quorum to conduct business. Present today are Senator Click Bishop, Senator Gary Stevens, Senator Jesse Keel, and myself, Vice Chair Senator Michicki. Do we have anyone online attending? No. Okay. Representative Puckduck, welcome. Representative Merrick, welcome. I don't see any other legislators in the building, but thanks for joining us today. And Senator Kawasaki is online as well. Resources Committee Aide N.T. Harbison, thanks for being here and serving. LAO moderator today is Nate Williams, and Juliana Singh is here from Records. At this time, please turn off your cell phones, and those on Teams, please keep yourself muted until it's your turn to speak. Today's agenda will have five items, and we're going to begin with Senate Bill 121, PFAS Use and Remediation, Fire Water Safety. We'll list the others as we bring them up throughout the afternoon. We're going to start with Senate Bill 121. There was discussion earlier in committee about the possibility of reducing costs, as well as the potential to hold the federal government responsible where they have required the use or testing of PFAS chemicals. We've worked with the bill sponsor, and he has agreed to put forward changes to SB 121 to achieve those desired goals. We appreciate that. Senator Keel, Senate Resources Office has worked with the bill sponsor as well to put forward a CS for this bill. And with that, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Resource Committee adopt the CS for Senate Bill Number 121, Resources, Version 32-LS0001/W, as our working document.
I will object for purposes of discussion. Senator Keel, would you or your staff please come forward to discuss the changes to the proposed CS?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Jesse Keel. It's my privilege to represent Senate District Q in Northern Southeast. With me is Catherine Schlinghide of my staff. The committee substitute makes two big changes and two small changes, Mr. Chairman. The first big change is that it removes the requirement that people exposed to PFAS be provided with blood tests. Mr. Chairman, the primary focus of the bill is on drinking water and preventing future releases of PFAS to Alaska's water and environment. It is our estimate based on some old analyses that this will take more than $1 million off the fiscal note. DEC, of course, will provide a fiscal note. That's my estimate, not theirs. I want to be clear. The bill also makes the other large change in the bill is that it adds a new provision saying that a government entity that required the release of PFAS-containing foam is liable for the drinking water testing and for providing drinking water in the areas of the release. Where the federal government forced an Alaskan entity's hand, the federal government should also bear some of the cost of providing clean water. The two small changes, Mr. Chairman, one is a technical fix to clarify that the liability provisions in the bill apply to providing the clean drinking water throughout. That was just a little error in the original draft. And then the other small fix is to update the effective date a year so that it's in keeping with the bill's movement this year.
Thank you, Representative Senator Keel. There are a lot of representatives in the room today. So, questions from committee members?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. With that, I will remove my objection so that we have the CS before us. Yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe, Senator, you could explain the removal of the blood tests. I mean, that's going to be a pretty important part of this if we're protecting the public. And are you just removing it because of the cost? And who's going to pick that up, that cost up, should we not do it?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Stevens, it is a significant cost and was an element that caused DEC some concern about their ability to recover all the costs from responsible parties, which would be the only time you'd see a fiscal impact in the bill. It was a difficult decision, no doubt. a tremendous number of Alaskans, especially our firefighters, have been exposed to PFAS. And so not directly providing those blood tests is maybe a disappointment to some. I will just note, however, that we don't require responsible parties for other contamination to provide blood tests for those contaminants as a consistent or regular thing. This would have been a different treatment for PFAS chemicals. And so we agreed to remove that from the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, if there's no more discussion on the bill or any final comments, thank you, Senator Keel and staff. Appreciate it very much. I'll entertain a motion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for Senate Bill Number 121 Resources Version 32-LS0001/W be moved from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations.
Okay, are there any objections? Senator Keel, you're okay with this bill moving out of committee?
I'll live with it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no objections, Senate Bill 121 Version W passes from committee with attached committee and individual fiscal notes. Senators, please stick around after the meeting, and we'll sign all of the prep work for the meeting at the end unless you have to leave before so. So moving right along, we'll next have HJR 34 before the committee. If we can have Representative Puckatuck as well as his staff, Trevor Fulton, here to present the resolution. Gentlemen, please put yourselves on the record and begin whenever you're ready.
Radio check. Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chairman and Honorable Senators. Thank you for obliging me in the request for hearing this resolution. My name is Josiah Putkadup. For the record, I represent House District 40, which is predominantly the North Slope Borough and Northwest Arctic Borough, with a few Doyon villages on the southern half of my district. Here with me is my staff. Introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Trevor Fulton, staff for Representative Puckatuck.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. House Joint Resolution 34 is a resolution that simply urges responsible development of NPRA. And it comes at a real important time considering what's happening geopolitically with energy independence discussions and energy needs. NPRA is the western half of the North Slope Borough, and it was set aside as a petroleum reserve in the 1920s by President Harding. And there's been a lot of stuff that's happened over the years with exploration wells and other things. But eventually, what it has come down to is Department of Interior's management of further development within the NPRA. And as you may recall, in 2013, there was an EIS that was handed down for development within the region, and it set aside certain lands that could not be explored for development. And that was a decision that was not endorsed by the big three, is what I call them, and that's our regional corporation, our local North Slope Borough Municipality, and also the regional tribal government, which is Inupiaq Community, the Arctic Slope. And so we have a strong thought that if there's going to be things that happen within our district that are going to affect our local economies, that we should at least have some consultation. And that didn't occur as transparent as it could have been. And so in 2020, there was another EIS that added about 7 million acres of land open to exploration within the NPRA. And that change came with the support of the big three, again, the regional corporation, the local municipality, and the regional tribal government. And then in January of this year, the current administration reversed that decision and went back to the 2013 EIS IEP. And again, that was with something that didn't have the endorsement of the local entities involved. And so all this resolution does is it asks that we maximize the acreage available for exploration within my district. And I will say NPRA lies wholly within District 40, lies wholly within the jurisdiction of the North Slope Borough. And if there's anybody that should have stake and a meaningful opinion, it would be those entities that are within that. But also the state, right? There's benefits that the state has through development in NPRA. So I can go into further detail on some of the effects of and positives for responsible development in NPRA, but I know that you're pressed for time. But if there are any specific questions, I can look to address them. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Bukatuck. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Representative Bukatuck, thank you for bringing this forward. I just got a quick question. Has the Secretary of Interior responded to any requests to meet with any of the leaders of the Norfolk Borough?
Well, as you might understand the bureaucracy of government, not yet. Myself, along with Chairman Rivak, have sent communications to the Secretary of Interior requesting conversations. We've also had conversations with some folks within the Department of Interior as a community. I know that our borough mayor has had the opportunity to speak with folks in their office about the importance of, responsible development in our district and what it means to the economic livelihood of our indigenous people up there. And so I think there's a meeting in the works right now, but I can't say that anybody's confirmed, but we do have anticipation that the Department of Interior staff, maybe the Secretary herself might be in attendance, and also Department of Energy folks. So.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman, and I'll just ask that if you could keep us notified as the Resource Committee, if that comes to pass, we'd be enthused. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Bishop, I'll do my best to keep everybody in the loop. And I think through legislative leadership, I think there's some opportunities for presiding officers to voice their opinion on those meetings. So as those discussions happen, I'll be sure to at least communicate via an email or something to report back. So.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions? Senator Stevens.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman, just to point out there are 12 co-sponsors in the Senate on your bill. So.
Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to thank members of the committee that I have cross-sponsored. I think I've got a majority of members sitting on the Senate Resources Committee that have cross-sponsored, so I appreciate that support.
Thank you. Senator, questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't cross-sponsor because I'm not sure I disagree with all of the changes in that new plan, but I do agree with the resolved in this resolution that calls for the maximum use of the land for development consistent with good environmental management and the renewable use of the resources. And I absolutely agree that local consultation, including tribal consultation, is critical. And if that didn't happen, we need to call it out.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Mr.
Yes.
Chairman, if I may, Senator brings up a good point, and that's something that people of our district and of the borough and of the interested parties up there have a long time searched to strike that balance between the proper management of all of our resources and maintaining access to all of our resources, renewable and non-renewable, fish and game, and that's kind of our thing up there, right? We're interested as far as making sure that the fish stay healthy. We're interested in making sure that the caribou migrations aren't disturbed hurtfully. We're interested in making sure that the ocean that we hunt and rely upon a lot of the marine mammal food that we eat stays healthy. But I think one of the things that has come up loudly more recently is the fact that in order to pursue all of those things, I'm going to need a four-stroke snow machine. I'm going to need an outboard. I'm going to need guns and ammunition. And all of that stuff plays into the cash economy, which is real and which is what we live in. I'm often reminded of the early struggles of trying to make sure that we had authority to get our taxing dollars to be able to afford flush toilets and running waters. And all of that came by maximizing the tools which were available to us. And it just so happens that we got a lot of oil and gas in our backyard. So I appreciate those comments, Senator.
Thank you, Representative. If there are no further questions, we are now going to invited testimony on the bill. Online, I see Bridget Anderson from Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. Ms. Anderson, can you hear us? And if so, identify yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Yes, I can hear you. Good afternoon. Chairman Michicki, and members of the committee. My name is Bridget Anderson, and I serve as the Vice President of External Affairs for Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, more commonly known as ASRC. ASRC is one of the 12 land-owning Alaska Native corporations created pursuant to the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, or ANCSA, and we represent the business interests of our over 13,000 Inupiat shareholders. For years, ASRC has advocated alongside the other North Slope entities for the responsible development of natural resources in our region, including those in the MPRA. This year, ASRC will celebrate its 50th anniversary. In 5 decades of existence, we have found ways to work together with our in-region partners, the state of Alaska, industry, and the federal government to meet the mandates and directives in ANCSA. One of those directives is to provide benefits to our shareholders. To that end, ASRC uses the land it was conveyed through ANCSA for both cultural and economic benefit of our shareholders. Some of our lands are within the boundaries of the MPRA. Despite the intent of ANCSA, we have been barred from developing some of our lands by the federal government. Over the years, ASRC has put significant resources toward engaging with the federal government to share our perspectives on responsible resource development in our region, striking that balance that Representative Plekacek talked about. Despite our sustained efforts and our willingness to work with the federal government, our perspectives are often drowned out by entities who have no ties to our region, nor have any understanding of the nuances of the ANCSA model of Indigenous representation. The choice by members of Congress and the administration to overlook our voices is not only frustrating, it is insulting. ASRC is keenly aware that advances in responsible resource development on the North Slope and in the MPRA have benefited our region and our state. Jobs directly related to the oil and gas industry and the revenues from development are two obvious benefits. But it goes beyond that for Alaska Native corporations. The ANCSA Regional Association has shared that since the passage of ANCSA, Alaska Native regional corporations have disbursed more than $3.5 billion through the revenue sharing provisions of ANCSA. Section 7I requires that 70% of revenues derived from subsurface and timber resources on ANCSA lands be shared with the other regional corporations. And Section 7J requires regional corporation recipients of 7I payments disperse 50% of that to the Alaska Native Village corporations in their region. Through the development of resources on our land, ASRC has contributed more than $1.5 billion to the other regional corporations through Section 7I. The development of MPRA has benefits for organizations and communities across our state. During this time of global uncertainty and always, we stand ready to be a part of a solution to support our nation's energy independence, national security interests, and support Alaskans and Americans. ASRC supports House Joint Resolution 34. This concludes my statement, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. I appreciate your testimony very much. Questions for Ms. Anderson?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
I was just thinking, these are pointed out, as Ms. Anderson said, that $1.5 billion has been shared with the other Native corporations around the state because of the 7I provisions, and that's really remarkable. And I know you've carried forward all Alaskan Native corporations because of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Other questions? Senator Kawasaki, I've got my text open in case you have questions during this hearing, so I just have it beside me here if you have anything. With that, we don't have any other invited testimony today, and we are going to open public testimony for HJR 34. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify on HJR 34? Is there anyone online who wishes to testify on HJR 34? Ms. Moriarty? I see you on the line there. If you want to provide your testimony, please.
Good afternoon, Senator Michicki and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. We appreciate the opportunity to express our unequivocal support for House Joint Resolution 34 and a special thanks to Representative Pocketuck and all the co-sponsors for sponsoring it. AOGA represents the majority of companies that have state and federal interests, both onshore and offshore. Our industry is the single most important economic driver in our state, accounting for roughly 25% of all jobs and wages, and it is now estimated, with the recent surge in oil prices, that the industry will provide local and state governments this coming fiscal year with over $5 billion. Federal lands, however, continue to provide some of the most promising opportunities for oil and gas leasing and development in Alaska, which obviously is particularly essential to North Slope communities. And I experienced many of these benefits firsthand as a former teacher in Akasuk, one of the villages in MPRA. Despite clear federal policy by Congress in 1980, requiring MPRA to be administered in a manner that responsibly increases the development and production of U.S. energy reserves, the first MPRA lease sale did not actually occur until 1998, and the first oil development did not commence, as we know, until 2015. As Chairman Pakatuk said earlier for the House Resources Committee, that at a time of global instability and rising energy costs, the benefits of energy independence could not be more important. So we joined the committee in urging the federal government to maximize the area available for development in MPRA so those benefits can be realized for the government, but most importantly, for the benefit of the local communities. So thank you again, Vice Chairman Michicki and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify this afternoon.
Thank you, Kara. Any questions for Ms. Moriarty? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony today. I see no one else online, and there's no one in the room, so I am closing public testimony on HJR 34 at this time. Any additional committee member questions or comments? I have just one brief one before we entertain a motion, and Ms. Anderson brought it up. The way that Alaskans are being ignored, not only locally but statewide, by the federal government. These decisions are not only insulting but largely illegal. We have so many obstacles in the way of Alaska's density that were guaranteed under ANCSA, NILCA, Statehood Compact, and each of them have been eroded since day one. And if this is a simple statement on that issue, and any similar statements on those issues, I'm going to support them. So I appreciate you bringing it forward very much, Representative Pakatuk. And with that, I'll entertain a motion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Joint Resolution Number 34, version 32-LS1578/B, be moved from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objection, HJR 34 version B passes from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations. Thank you, Representative Pakatuk.
Thank you very much.
Next, the committee will take up HB 304. Here to present today, we have Representative Merrick and her staff, Ms. Jones. Also online for questions, we have Richard Fagg, president of Eagle River Lions Club, as well as representatives from the department. Thank you, Representative Merrick and Ms. Jones. Please come forward and identify yourselves for the record and present your testimony.
For the record, Kelly Merrick, House District 14, and with me today is my staff, Jamie Jones. Thank you, Chair Michicki and members of the Senate Resources Committee, for hearing House Bill 304 today, which is Chugach State Park, Eagle River Lions Club. House Bill 304 is an exciting opportunity for my home community of Eagle River, but this legislation will impact many, many Alaskans that enjoy this park. It's a special place right at the heart of Eagle River. In fact, my history with Lions Park goes all the way back to the 80s when my family traveled from here in Juneau to Eagle River with the Stroller White group to participate in the Highland Games there. I have a long history, and all of my neighbors have a story about Lions Park. Their kids have played baseball there. They've attended town hall meetings, watched their children on the playground, danced and celebrated at weddings and concerts and festivals. And every 4th of July, they sponsor a very beautiful fireworks display. And personally, my family has spent many, many hours at Lions Park at the Stan Brown Fields there. My two boys, Hunter and Brody, grew up playing Pop Warner football there. Their sister, Roxy, was a Panthers cheerleader there, rooting on her brothers. And then my husband, Joey, coached hundreds of football players there. So we've celebrated state championships and made a lot of special memories at the Lions Park. So I thank the committee for your time today and your thoughtful consideration for your support. I'm hoping that you will look favorably upon this gem in the heart of Eagle River. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Butel from the Department of Natural Resources. He has a brief PowerPoint to share, and he will go over the details, including that this bill has a zero fiscal note.
Mr. Butel, please identify yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan Butel from the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation in the Department of Natural Resources. And I want to just run through the slides here. So just for those who aren't familiar, Lions Club Park, it is a popular community park, as Representative Merrick mentioned, centrally located in Eagle River at Eagle River Road, Eagle River Loop Road. I believe you can see on the map there, it's right next to Greening Middle School and across the street from Walmart. It's very popular for baseball, softball, football, a bunch of other sports, fields. There's neighborhood walks taking place there, and there's a lot of community gatherings that take place at the Lions Club. Just a little bit on the park and Chugach State Park. So the Lions Club developed and operated the park under a series of permits from DNR. Their current 20-year permit expires January 2nd, 2024, and cannot be renewed, as I'll discuss in a few slides. I also want to point out that the organized sports field, the clubhouse with alcohol sales, and the community park are all just very different from the rest of Chugach State Park. DNR believes that the Eagle River community will be better served by Lions Club Park if the Eagle River Lions Club are allowed to operate the park under their direct ownership. This does require modification of the Chugach State Park boundary as found in statute, which is why we are before you today. A little bit of history. DNR acquired this parcel in 1961, first issued a permit to the Lions in 1964. The club began developing the park in the 60s and 70s, built baseball fields, clubhouse buildings, and all the other facilities. Chugach State Park was designated by the legislature in 1970, including all state land in this section or square mile, subject to valid existing rights. This section appears to have been included because Eagle River does flow through the southern portion of the section. If we jump ahead a slide here, hopefully we're tracking along okay. Land and Water Conservation Fund grants from the federal government were first used in Chugach State Park in 1970, shortly after the park was designated. These LWCF grants require the state to preserve the park where they're used for outdoor recreation in perpetuity. Any use other than outdoor recreation constitutes a conversion and requires replacement land of equal value, the out-of-the park, and I should emphasize that is appraised fair market value, not recreational value. So the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation has renewed the permit for two additional 20-year terms. Current permit expires, as mentioned, in January 2024. Then in 2013, the State Supreme Court issued a decision, SOP v. DNR, which requires permits for use of legislatively designated state parks must be revocable at will. This means that we cannot issue a new permit to the Lions Club since facilities cannot be readily removed. So I now have a few slides with some pictures of the park. The baseball and softball field, and then we jump ahead, and there's the football field and the horseshoes. I didn't get a good picture of the tennis courts, but the tennis courts were recently rehabbed, so I will let some of the club members and other in testimony talk about the club even more. There's the clubhouse, there's a picnic facility, there's a playground, lots of great stuff there. Yeah, we'll let the other others who will testify, and you can see the letters of support that have been submitted about the park. If we then jump ahead here to the, I have a slide about Chugach State Park, just briefly contrasting with Lions Cove Park, covers about 485,000 acres, mostly undeveloped mountains from Knick River Road to Turning and Arm, east of Anchorage. Visitor activities are primarily sightseeing, hiking, UTVing, snowmobiling, skiing, hunting, fishing, and other outdoor recreation. The facilities are largely trails, trailheads, campgrounds, and public use cabins. And as you'll note, it has no other facilities like Lions Cove Park for organized team sports. No Alaska State Park has a facility comparable to Lions Cove Park. And the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation generally lacks experience, funding, or authority to operate facilities for these types of sports. So that brings us to our LWCF conversion and replacement land. As mentioned, the Land and Water Conservation Fund, or LWCF, requires replacement land of equal value be added to Chugach State Park to replace the Lions Cove Park parcel that would be removed by this bill and conveyed to the Lions. There are four parcels of general state land that are already state-owned, three are in Eagle River, one on Pioneer Peak, which are the proposed replacement parcels. All four are steep mountainsides adjacent to Chugach State Park. The current primary use seems to be wildlife habitat, with occasional hikers or hunters passing through. None of them has any active DNR authorizations or known development or mineral potential. The inclusion of these parcels in Chugach State Park will not meaningfully change access for hunters, hikers, or others who currently visit the parcel. So we jump ahead. I have a little table summarizing the parcel. As mentioned, 40-acre parcel for Lions Cove Park that comes out of the Chugach State Park. The tax assessed value, which is $1.4 million. We will have to have all of these parcels appraised as part of the LWCF conversion process to ensure that the replacement land does exceed the value. And then you can see there's the four parcels that would be added to Chugach State Park. I can now talk just a little bit about each of the four replacement parcels. So you can see what those are here. Parcel one is in the Meadow Creek Valley, a little bit south of Mount Baldy for those who've hiked above the Eagle River. It covers about 60 acres and is kind of down in the valley at the low point of the photo. Going to parcels two and three here. Parcel two covers about 60 acres on some steep slopes near Berry Hill Road. And parcel three covers 24 acres on steep slopes above Eagle River Road. I have some photos of those two parcels on this next slide. You can see nice views across Eagle River Valley and steep looking uphill, mostly birch trees. The final parcel here, parcel four, is a big parcel out on the northeast slopes of Pioneer Peak above Knick River Road. And the Pioneer Peak Trail that already exists does go through there. So, in conclusion, the proposed bill directs DNR to complete the LWCF conversion, retain some road and utility rights of way, and convey the Lions Cove Park to the Eagle River Lions Club, and then Lions Cove Park will be secured as a community park. I should mention that the bill does direct DNR to retain a reversionary interest in the park so that it has to be used as a community park by the Lions, and if they wanted to sell it or something, they wouldn't be able to do so. They would have to give it back to DNR in this situation. Chugach State Park boundaries are updated, and access to these park additions for hunters, hikers, and other visitors is unchanged. Thank you very much. That's it for the presentation, but I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Butel. Looks like we have a question from Senator Bishop.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's the timeline for completing the appraisal and the timeline to conclude and make this transaction complete?
Well, we've already started conversations with appraisers, and assuming the bill has moved forward, we will work on hiring them as soon as possible. I'm guessing it will take them the entire field season to get that completed and to wrap up the various other pieces of paperwork for the conversion, which would then leave us with finishing up the transaction probably a year from now.
So 12 months from now, estimated that this would be completed and everybody's happy.
I that might be optimistic, and that's why we're trying to get it done this session and now, so that we can be sure we have it done before that permit expires in January of 2024.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Butel, I have a question. I notice after the land is conveyed, or while the land is being conveyed, there's a requirement for the club to pay DNR $50,000 for the Lions Club Park to cover your costs. Is that the case?
Correct. Thank you. Yes, Senator.
So there's no cost to the state, hence the lack of a fiscal note.
Yes, correct. Sorry, through the chair. There's a zero fiscal note. The Lions Club, we have a agreement with the Lions Club Memorandum of Understanding where the Lions will pay for the cost of the third-party appraiser, contract appraiser, and they will also pay DNR to cover the various administrative costs and staff time costs that we will incur. But there's a zero fiscal note.
So Also, Mr. Butel, I'm also assuming that over the last 50 years, most of the improvements have been at the cost of the Lions Club and the community support for that club. There's no ongoing maintenance or anything else that would be required by the state. Once the land is conveyed, it now belongs to the Lions Club for all improvements, maintenance, etc.
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. The club would own the parcel and the improvements, and they would be responsible for any ongoing costs. The state would not have any ongoing costs.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Butel? Seeing none, we'll now take up invited testimony, unless you have any additional comments you'd like to make for the record.
No, thank you. Continue okay. to invited testimony. It would be wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Merrick. Online, we have Richard Fagg, president of the Eagle River Lions Club. Mr. Fagg, please put yourself on the record and begin when you're ready.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and honorable senators. My name is Richard Fagg. I'm the president of the Eagle River Lions Club. I live in Eagle River. And as president of the Eagle River Lions Club, it's been my honor and pleasure to oversee the operation and upkeep of Eagle River Lions Park over the past year. The park itself is the only facility of its kind in the whole Eagle River Chugach area, and its importance to our community is incredible and cannot be emphasized enough. When you see the different youth sports organizations that hold sporting events and practices for the youth of our community in our park, and when you see all the people who enjoy it for the recreational activities, both in winter and summer, it's hard to imagine our community without this park. From our tennis courts, which when the refurbishment is completed will host both tennis and pickleball tournaments and play, to our football fields that the Pop Warner teams use, and our baseball fields that the boys baseball and the girls softball teams utilize, to our basketball courts that in the summer are constantly in use, and to our horseshoe pits that people often enjoy, the options for activities in our park are truly, truly great. All of the aforementioned organizations are not charged anything to use the Lions Park. We only ask that they help with some of the maintenance of the areas they use. We also have plans for creating a new dog park this summer for people to bring their dogs and walk them in a safe environment. We also plan on completely renovating our playground and adding new playground equipment for the children of the community to enjoy. HB 304 will allow our Lions Club to continue to maintain and promote these activities for our community members and keep the park open for everyone to enjoy. Please support this important legislation and allow us to keep doing this important work for another 60 years and beyond. Thank you very much for your support, and if you have any questions, I'm here for you.
Thank you, Mr. Fagg. Questions? Committee members? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. We are now going to move on to public testimony for HB 304. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on HB 304? Seeing none, is there anyone online who wishes to testify on HB 304? I see Mr. Ryan Johnston, Second Vice President, Eagle River Lions. Mr. Johnston, please identify yourself for the record and provide your public testimony.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to speak in support of HB 304. My name is Ryan Johnston. I'm a 40-year resident, second generation born in the Eagle River community. I am the current building manager, second vice president, and will be stepping behind Tiny for presidency in July. I've played myself, pitched on each and every mound there at Connect, so it's many of my family members. So the park really holds a special place in my heart. It would be Eagle River Club, our club honor to continue to help manage and develop this valuable resource for our community. And I appreciate your support for this property transfer so that we can continue our stewardship of this Lions Community Park. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Johnston. Questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else that would like to testify on HB 304? Oh, look at that. Senator Stoltz. Senator, would you please identify yourself for the record and please provide your testimony.
Hi, Bill Stoltz. I hail from Chugiak, and I'm a member of the Lions and a half-decade-plus user of facilities there. I'll just try to make this as quick as I can. This is a good bill, which is going to allow good people, my fellow Lions, to continue to do the good work on behalf of the good people of my community, especially the youth. I believe it's basically, I could probably use the adjective good a lot more times, but I'll just say the last one to wish you a good day.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Appreciate you calling in. I see no others other than for questions. So with that, I'm going to close public testimony on HB 304. Are there any questions or comments from committee members?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
Senator Stevens. This was sailing along pretty solidly until we heard from former Senator Bill Stoltz, and I remembered all the things he's done to us when he was down here. But despite all of that, I'm still supportive.
Thank you, Senator. Seeing no more questions or comments or concerns from the committee, I would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill number 304, version 32-LS0928/I, be moved from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any objections? Seeing no objection, HB 304, version I, passes from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations. Thank you, Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Chair and committee.
We're now moving on to Senate Bill 239, Governor's Proposed Royalty and Kind Legislation, beginning with SB 239, though I believe the presentation covers both 239 as well as Senate Bill 240. So, legislators, please keep in mind we're reviewing this legislation. Here to present Senate Bill 239, we have Johnny Mesa, Commercial Analyst, Commercial Section, Division of Oil and Gas. And John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, DNR. One moment. Thank you, Mr. Mesa. Please put yourself on the record, and if Mr. Crowther is with you as well, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, for the record. This is John Crowther with the Department of Natural Resources, and with me is, as you mentioned, Johnny Mesa, and he'll begin the presentation as he puts himself on the record.
Hello, members of the committee. My name is Johnny Mesa. I've worked in the commercial section here at the Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources. We prepared this presentation where we are planning to describe two proposed contracts for the sale of royalty oil in kind, and we have this in front of you because legislative approval is required before the DNR commissioner can execute these contracts with these in-state refineries. As you can see on page number 2, we have an agenda for the presentation where we will begin describing what is royalty in kind, the history of sales for royalty in kind, the statutory and regulatory mandate for this process, and the process that DNR has followed for these proposed contracts. And lastly, we're going to review the contract terms that we have, the department has negotiated with Marathon and PetroStar separately. So moving on with the first section, which is going to describe what is royalties in kind. Alaska, and we are on page number 4, Alaska Statute 3805-182 provides to the DNR Commissioner the authority to select its royalty, oil or gas, either in money slash or value or in kind, provided that the Commissioner shows that doing so is in the best interest of the state. To the right side, you will see a copy of the letter that the department has submitted to the legislature showing the determination to take its royalty oil in value. When the department selects its royalty in value, the lessees market that royalty oil or gas alongside their own equity production, and we receive a share of the proceeds subject to fair market valuation. On the other hand, when we take it in kind, the state is the party responsible for marketing that resource, and that's the main difference between in value and in kind. Moving on to the next slide, given the statutory language, the department enters into a contract with the lessees for the oil and gas lease, which provides a definition of the royalty rate, the percentage, and the ability for the commissioner to take it in value or in kind, the oil and gas royalty component. So you can see that from the very inception of the oil and gas lease, the statutory language and as well as the contract language allows the department to participate in this market as a resource owner by selling its royalty oil in kind. To the right side of that slide, we have an example of the oil and gas unit agreement, which reflects such language when we have a unitized collection of oil and gas leases. And on the next slide, we have a map of the North Slope detailing the oil and gas units where the state has a resource ownership. And when we refer to royalty oil in kind in this context of the proposed contracts, we're referring to the sale of royalty oil from the fields where the state is the resource owner. So, for example, fields such as Prudhoe Bay or Kuparuk. You can see on the western side of this map fields such as Greater Moose's Tooth, where the state doesn't have any resource ownership. So we wouldn't be able to take royalty oil in kind from that field. Moving on to the next slide. We're going to transition into the brief description of the history of the royalty in kind program for the state. On page number 8, you can see a graph on the right side showing the history of the royalty oil from the North Slope on the blue area in that graph, and the line representing the share of that royalty oil from the North Slope that the state has decided to take in kind. You can see that the state has participated in the sale of royalty oil in kind from almost the beginning of production from the North Slope and has done it consistently throughout that period up until recently. You can see also that that share of royalty oil in kind that the state has sold has varied throughout that period because of naturally the level of production from the North Slope, but also because of the other elements such as the royalty rate, its ownership in the different leases, the demand for royalty oil that we see in the market, and the ability of the state to select its royalty oil from different fields. About 97% of that royalty oil in kind has come from the North Slope, and only the remaining part with respect to oil has come from Coquimbo and has been the case for between the period of 1970s and 1980s and close to 1991 as well. Moving on to the next slide, page number 9. We have now, we focus now on the types of contracts and the buyers for these royalty in-kind sales. You can see over 900 million barrels of royalty oil has been dedicated to the sale via a non-competitive disposition. Less than 5% of that royalty in-kind oil, about 46 million barrels, has been sold via competitive sales. And this will become important later on as we describe the statutory and regulatory mandate for this process. So the large majority of these royalty oil in kind has been sold to in-state refineries, which is also another statutory requirement. But in a few cases, we have sold that oil for export outside of Alaska. You can see that some of these companies have been in-state refineries, such as the Nikiski refinery in Chevron, that Chevron operated, and which was built in 1963 and dismantled in 1981. For the North Pole refinery, operated by MAPCO, William, and Flint Hills Resources, which was built in 1977. For the Petrostar, North Pole, and Valdez refineries, and also Tesoro, and nowadays operated by Marathon, for the other Nikiski refinery, which was built in 1969. The table below shows you the duration of these royalty in-kind contracts, and you can see, much like the previous graph that we presented to you, that the state has participated in these sales almost since the beginning of production from the North Slope. And we can move on to the next section of our presentation, which discusses the statutory and regulatory mandate for this process of sale of royalty oil in kind. The first one is that before the DNR commissioner can execute these contracts, we need to have legislative approval. In order to do so, we need the written recommendation from the Alaska Royalty Oil and Gas Development and Advisory Board, and of course the approval by the legislature. There are some exceptions in the statute for this approval, and they apply only if the proposed sale is to relieve storage or market conditions, or if the sale of oil is at most 400 barrels of oil per day. Moving on to the next page, which is page number 12. Here's a recap of the most recent contracts for the sale of royalty oil in kind, beginning with the Tesoro in 2016, which was a multi-year contract for 5 years, followed by the Petrostar contract in 2016, also a multi-year contract. On the right side of that table, you can see under the heading Royalty Board Review and Legislative Approval that given that these were multi-year contracts, they were both reviewed by the Royalty Board and the legislature. On the other hand, we have one-year contracts for Marathon and Petrostar in 2021 that lasted only 1 year, and because of the exception to that we just went over in the previous slide, they didn't require the review of the board or the legislature. Nowadays, we are in front of you, we're presenting multi-year contracts again with Marathon and Petrostar for 3 and 5 years respectively, and they have been reviewed by the Royalty Board. We are presenting their written recommendation to the legislature as part of the packet that we are providing in front of you. And now we are in front of you seeking legislative approval for these proposed contracts. We can proceed to the next slide. Continuing with the Royalty Board review, the statute requires that the Royalty Board considers the revenue needs of the state and other second-order effects of the sale regarding investment, employment, and cost to the state, the effects on the labor market, and also environmental impacts. In addition to that, on the right side, the Department of Natural Resources has to consider the projected effects of the sale on the economy of the state and the benefits that this could provide to refining or processing the oil and gas in the state. So it is a very comprehensive review of the potential effects of these contracts, and they are included in the written best interest finding by the Department of Natural Resources that were published. Page number 14. Page number 14 provides examples of these reports that were written by the Royalty Board and submitted to the legislature on March 15 of this year. Page 15 provides the statutory language for the requirement that these sales of royalty oil in kind be done via competitive basis. However, the DNR commissioner may find that it could be in the best interest of the state to do it in a non-competitive basis. And when deciding that, we need to provide a written finding, which is the contents of the best interest findings that DNR published in January and March for each of these contracts. As part of that process, DNR publishes its solicitation of interest letter, where we seek interest from the market. And throughout this process, as you will see in later slides in this presentation, we invite comments by the public, and the Royalty Board Review, being an independent and autonomous body from the department, also provides a review of these proposed contracts. Page 16 just has a map of Alaska and indicating where these local refineries are located in the interior region and South Central, referring to the PetroStar refinery in North Pole, but also in Valdez, as well as the Nikiski refinery operated currently by Marathon and formerly by Tesoro. The statute has a presumption that the sale of royalty oil and gas needs to first make sure that we are meeting the internal or local demand before we decide to sell this royalty oil for export outside of Alaska. Page 17 has some information, current information on these in-state refineries, the parties to which we are proposing to sell royalty oil in kind from the North Slope. You can see information regarding the Nikiski refinery operated by Marathon. They currently produce 55,000 barrels per day of refined product, including a mix of jet fuel, gasoline, and other refined products. Most of them are consumed in Alaska and in a small portion outside of Alaska. With respect to PetroStar, we have information on their maximum capacity for the Valdez and North Pole refineries with 60,000 barrels per day and 22,000 barrels per day, respectively. They do produce a mix of jet fuel, ultra-low sulfur, diesel, asphalt, and heating oil, but no gasoline. Their product is also mainly sold and consumed here in Alaska with some exemptions, as indicated in the slide. As you can also see, that the typical sources of crude for these refineries are Alaskan crude from Cook Inlet and North Slope for the case of the Nikiski refinery, and 20% coming from other places in the U.S. or other countries. But for the PetroStar refineries, it's entirely Alaska North Slope crude. In terms of employment, these refineries employ between 200 and 300 employees each, and that is something we consider as well in the best interest findings for why these proposed contracts should we consider that they are in the best interest of the state. Moving on to page 18, we provide a graph and showing another element for why these proposed contracts meet the statutory already regulatory requirement for regarding the revenue needs to the state, in particularly how the value that the state obtains from selling royalty oil in kind is better than what it would receive had the state selected to receive its royalty in money or in value. So the graph shows on the gray bars, the volumes of oil that were sold since 2008. The blue circles represent the instances where the price of royalty oil in kind, according to these contracts, generated a premium over what the state received when receiving a portion of the royalty in value from the producers. There were 21 instances represented by the red squares where this value was lower, but there were only 21 cases out of 168 months for this period. So overall, the state received on average 93 cents per barrel in addition to what it would have received if we selected all of our royalty oil in value. This translates into $137 million of revenue in addition to the state. Next, we're going to transition into a description of the process that DNR followed for the sale of royalty oil in kind. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a transparent process and mandated by the statutes and regulations. What we do, starting on the left side, is we determine when our current contracts for sale of royalty oil in kind are going to expire. And then we make a decision to offer the future royalty oil in kind for sale. We keep the royalty board informed of this decision. And then we consider the requirements by the statute, which is to conduct these sales in a competitive or non-competitive sale, whether this royalty oil should be dedicated within the state or for export, and also how long this contract should be. Then we publish a solicitation of interest where we obtain information from the market participants. We evaluate these responses on step number four. And for this process, we decided to conduct a non-competitive sale, and we inform the royalty board of that decision. We conduct bilateral negotiations with these companies who have shown interest. And once we agreed into tentative terms, we publish a preliminary best interest finding, which is subject to the review by the royalty board and to a 30-day public comment period. For this proposed contract, we did not receive any comments from the public. And like I said earlier, the Royalty Board decided to provide written recommendation for the approval of these contracts to the legislatures, both for Marathon and PetroStar. After that, the department published a final best interest finding and submitted a bill to the legislature, and this is the step where we are right now. Like I said earlier, we cannot, the DNR commissioner cannot execute these contracts without approval by the legislature.
Mr. Mesa?
Yes.
I have a question for you. It looks to me on slide 18 that just on average between 08 and 21 that total proceeds were 10.99 with sort of $137 million premium if overtaking the royalty barrels in value. So that's about 1.5%. Is that correct? Is my math correct?
I believe so. Sure.
So one could look at it that versus 12.5% royalty, royalty in kind is closer to 14. Is that kind of a appropriate way to view the difference between RIK and RIV?
Sure, that could be one interpretation. Yes, although to be clear, that extra percentage that you're referring to doesn't come from the producers. It comes from the refiners in this case.
Yeah, I was kind of more looking at a bottom line than the source of the premium. Thank you. Okay, next slide.
Yep. And I believe we are on page 21, which just provides a description of the timeline of all of these process that we conducted. You can see that at the top, we have the one-year contracts for royalty oil in kind with Marathon and PetroStar that I mentioned in a previous slide that didn't have to go through the review of the royalty board or the legislature and meeting the exceptions described in the statute. But with these proposed multi-year contracts, we do have to present it to the Royalty Board and Legislature, and we have to go through a series of steps, and which are indicated here, beginning with the publication of the solicitation of interest, 30-day wait period to get the responses from the participants, the termination of a non-competitive sale, negotiation time, publication of the preliminary best interest finding, a public comment period of 30 days, review by the Royalty Board, publication of the final best interest finding, and now review by the legislature before the DNR Commissioner can execute this contract. And now we can transition to Section 5, which is going to discuss in more detail the specific terms of these proposed contracts for your consideration. On page 23, you can see the same table that we looked at before, describing the previous contracts, but also at the last, for the last two rows, the proposed contracts with Marathon and Petrostar. You can see under the column with the heading royalty barrels for sale that these royalty barrels are not as large as they used to be in the past. Currently, based on the capacity and the current production of refined products from the refineries, the royalty oil that we are selling to these refineries represent between 10 and 20% of their production of refined products. What is common across these contracts is that the value of royalty oil in kind is calculated in the same way, following a net, what we call a net back methodology, because DNR is selling its royalty oil at the field. And in order to do so, we net back all of the elements related to transportation costs and adjustments for quality of the different sources of oil. One key element in this calculation is what we call the RIK differential, which is just another deduction in order to arrive to this royalty price at the field. On the last column in this table, you can see that such term, the RIK differential, has varied throughout time. And the currently proposed contracts have a value of $2.23 per barrel for Marathon and $2.25 per barrel for Peterson. The next page will provide a graphical representation of this net back methodology in order to calculate the royalty, the price of royalty oil in kind at the field. On the left side is a graphical representation of what the royalty oil price would be when the state selects its royalty in value. Because the oil is sold mainly outside of Alaska in the lower 48, and when we take in value, the state receives a share of the proceeds from the lessees. So in order to calculate the price of royalty oil in value at the field, we need to deduct all of the transportation costs. And you can see highlighted in yellow that one element there is the marine transportation allowance, so that the cost to transport the oil via tankers. These numbers that you see attached or right next to these elements are for illustrative purposes and to show how the royalty in kind differs with respect to royalty in value. On the right side, it is the netback methodology for royalty in kind. And the main difference here is that rather than that oil being sold in the lower 48, this oil is being sold within the state. And we no longer deduct the marine transportation cost, but we have an adjustment that we call the RIK differential, highlighted in yellow. So for illustrative purposes of this example, almost all of the elements are the same, with the exception of marine transportation and RIK differential. The purpose of this is to show where that premium that Senator Michiki referred to earlier comes from, which is precisely that difference. That oil is no longer being transported to lower 48, but rather sold in Alaska, and therefore there is no marine transportation cost. So therefore, that's how we arrive at a premium of $1.25 in this example. Page 25 provides historical information of the difference between the marine transportation allowance and this value of the RIK differential. The vertical distance between the blue line and the gray line gives us evidence of the source of this premium that DNR has obtained throughout these sales of royalty oil in kind. And that gives an indication for when we look at the dashed line, this location differential, for why the value of the RRK differential has been increasing lately for these proposed contracts. Page 26 contains a description of other provisions within the contract, and what's important here is that it highlights that both the buyer, the refineries, and the seller, in this case the state, have flexibility. For the buyer, they can have flexibility in nominating 0 barrels of royalty oil. They can have flexibility in requesting a reduction of what they would nominate, or even increasing their nomination. For the state, there is also flexibility because we do not guarantee any sort of amount, quality, or source of royalty oil, because we receive royalty oil as a derivative of production, so we cannot guarantee a specific quantity to be sold to the buyer. In that way, we have this provision related to proration, when if we don't have enough barrels to sell, then the state's interests are protected in that way as well. Page 27 also details other provisions in the contract, such as financial assurance, and this has to do in the event that our buyer is not able to pay the invoices for the sale of royalty oil. So the buyer and the guarantor provide the state an option between a letter of credit, a surety bond, or an opinion letter, as indicated in the slide. The value of that financial assurance is calculated at 90 days worth of royalty oil for Marathon and 50 days worth of royalty oil for Petrostar. And that has been the outcomes of conducting these negotiations separately with each of these parties. We have a retroactivity provision as well. Should anything change in the calculation of royalty oil that we highlighted before, after the buyer paid the invoice, the state has the ability to send a readjusted invoice to the buyer, in that way protecting the interests of the state, but also of the buyer. And lastly, there are other provisions encouraging the buyer, in this case the refineries, to process that royalty oil within the state, and as well as to employ Alaska residents to the extent that it is possible. The last slide, and we are on page 28, just highlight the cash benefits from these proposed sales. Beginning from the multi-year contracts in 2016, the five-year contract with Tesoro and Petrostar, you can see on the column to the far right that the additional revenues to the state was $31 million and $23 million respectively. The one-year contracts in 2021 generated $3 million so far, and $0.7 million so far, only with 1 month of data. And we estimate that the currently proposed multi-year contracts will generate for Marathon between $3 and $14 million, and for Petrostar between $17 and $19 million of extra revenue to the state. And that concludes the presentation.
Thank you very much for that presentation. I have a question from Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meza, on page 27, on the employment of Alaska residents, is that referenced by statute or regulation?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, as far as I know, that is not directly referencing any statute or regulation within the contract. It's its own provision that exists only within the contract.
Senator Bishop, Deputy Commissioner John Crowther, for the record, through the chair, I would say that the department's basis, statutory basis for that provision is its general authority to negotiate terms. We look to, in the course of that negotiation, the criteria laid out in statute, both that the Royalty Board is reviewing these contracts for and that the department is directed to consider. And that includes things like the in-state employment, economic activity, those in-state economic factors, and that's the basis for the provision, and the statutory basis for it is the general authority to negotiate. I hope that answers your question, sir.
That's good. I appreciate it. I like it. I'm just I'm the Alaska Hire guy.
Thanks, Senator Bishop. Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a first question on a pretty basic, rudimentary level. A lot more royalty barrels than we're selling here in kind. How does the department decide which fields to sell from, and what are the factors in that decision?
Senator Keel, through the chair, the department selects its royalty oil following two considerations. One, where we expect to obtain royalty in value to be the lowest value in such a way that we are substituting the lowest value of royalty oil with a relatively higher or comparatively higher value royalty oil in kind. But also we select our royalty oil in kind from fields that generate the largest amount of royalty oil, such as Prudhoe Bay and Kupar.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple different topics?
Certainly, Senator Keel.
Thank you. Mr. Meza, you had a chart on page 25 that compared the marine transportation charge to the royalty in kind differential. And just eyeballing the chart, it kind of looks like about $2 a barrel, but that's not where we end up ahead, right? We end up ahead in the 80 to 90 cents a barrel. Can you describe what the difference is there?
Senator Keel, through the chair, certainly. If you would allow me, I would like to refer to there was a slide showing a comparison of how royalty oil in kind versus royalty in value are determined from a graphical point of view. And you correctly identify that the main source of premium for these royalty in kind contracts come from the difference between the marine transportation cost and the RIK differential. However, there are other elements in this netback methodology that could create differences in order to reduce that initial premium that we obtain. And as part of that graph where we show this 93 cents per barrel premium, that's precisely the combined effect of these differences between these elements of the netback methodology.
To follow up? So, Mr. Meza, would you be willing to provide a couple of examples of things that reduce that premium by the end of the final calculation? I don't need you to run through every month, but just a couple of examples of what those factors are.
Senator Keel, through the chair, yes. If we look again at page number 24 of the presentation, you can see that we have numbers indicated there on the left and the right side. For the purposes of this example, the only difference comes from marine transportation and RIK differential. The other numbers, such as step number 3, other transportation costs and adjustments, they are both $6 for both cases. However, in reality, they are not the same. They are slight variations. For example, for the purposes of valuing royalty in value, this valuation is determined by some settlement agreements that the state entered with producers in the early 90s. These settlement agreements have different ways and unique ways of determining, for example, how the price of ANS oil should be calculated in the U.S. West Coast. That in itself creates a difference between royalty in value and royalty in kind. As much as we would like them to be the same, it is by design impossible to make them identical because we have different settlement agreements with various producers in the North Slope when we receive a royalty in value.
Okay. And there are one more?
Yes, certainly. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meza, On slide 27, you under the retroactivity column, you mentioned an eight-year period to adjust invoices. There was a discussion in the best interest finding, about not being able to retroactively true up some of the, I think it was transportation charges, unless they were changes that were required by FERC. Can you help me square what I read in the best interest finding, which I understood some portion of, but not all of, with this notion that we've got 8 years to go back and adjust?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I believe that when we refer to this retroactivity provision in the contract, what we have experienced throughout the life of the existing and prior contracts is that precisely when there was a change dictated by FERC or the Regulatory Commission of Alaska regarding some of the tariffs in some of the pipelines, and that change came after the invoice was sent and paid by the buyer, what we, DNR, would do is incorporate this new value dictated by these independent bodies and recalculate that invoice. At this point, I do not recall precisely, and if you will indulge me in following up with you after today's presentation, precisely what were those cases that you are referring to where we did not retroactively adjust?
Mr. Chairman, sure. I don't have the page I was reading in front of me, so I'm happy to follow up with Mr. Mesa afterwards.
Okay, thank you, Senator Keel. Mr. Mesa, I just had a question on slide 28, and I'm just kind of highlighting the reason why we sell our oil, royalty in kind. So the first four boxes on the far right are actuals, although the PetroStar 2021 contract probably is not exactly up to date, but that $56 million in actuals are based on the contract price. I guess the question I have is the estimate between 3 and 14 for the Marathon 22 and the 17 and 19 in the PetroStar is the likely potential differential of marine transportation costs in relation to oil price. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, your first reference was correct that these are estimates and the four first numbers were actuals. In your second reference, the estimate does come from the premium that we were referring to earlier, which you indicate the difference between the marine transportation cost and the RIK differential that we identified in the contract. There are other elements in the pricing methodology that could expand on this estimate or reduce it. Another element that affects this estimate is how much the buyer, the refiner, ultimately decides to buy from the state. As you can see in this table, both have a range of barrels. For Marathon, between 10 and 15,000 barrels per day, and PetroStar from 10,000 to 12,500 barrels per day. So more than that, they also have the ability to nominate zero barrels according to the contract should they go into maintenance operations for their refineries.
Okay, thank you for that. Sorry, I'm a gas guy and always thinking take or pay, but that's not the case now. So along those lines, is there any opportunity or any probability that the state goes into a negative in an RIK agreement?
Mr. Chair, I would say theoretically, the answer would be yes. If we are referring, for example, to April of 2020, where prices were negative for a couple of days for oil, which if we are to check the Department of Revenue website, the price of ANS, in fact, went negative for about a day or two. However, with respect to the valuation of royalty oil in kind, that price is determined as the average throughout the month. So in that way, we have that layer of protection for the state.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mays. I appreciate the theoretical. Alaskans want to hear. They like those actuals boxes, so the price would have to remain negative for the sum total that's longer than the amount of days that oil was positive. So the probability is essentially non-existent. Is that correct?
I would say so, Mr. Turk.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Mesa and Mr. Crowther, for your comments and testimony. We're going to move on to public testimony for Senate Bill 239. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 239? Seeing no one, is there anyone online who wishes to testify? And I see Doug Tapatos online. If you can hear us, please state your name for the record and provide your public testimony. Tapatos.
Thank you. Sorry. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Doug Tapatos, and I'm the President, Chief Executive Officer of PetroStar Incorporated. I am testifying today in support of PetroStar's proposed five-year royalty oil contract, which is now before this committee. By way of background, PetroStar is a wholly owned subsidiary of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and thus the state's only Alaskan-owned refiner. In addition to fuel distribution terminals located in Anchorage, Valdez, Kodiak, Unalaska Island, and the interior, PetroStar also operates two of Alaska's three commercial refineries, one of those located in North Pole and the other in Valdez. Both of these refineries draw crude oil directly from the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, or TAPS. In fact, TAPS is PetroStar's only source of crude oil supply, which means that the contracts, such as the one before you now, are absolutely essential to PetroStar's continued operation. From this crude oil, PetroStar produces a variety of products, including jet fuel for commercial airlines, and well over 90% of the jet fuel consumed at Department of Defense and U.S. Coast Guard installations located across the state. We also produce heating oil for residential and commercial customers, ultra-low sulfur diesel fuels, fuels for both the on- and off-road uses, and that includes marine diesel fuels. We also produce asphalt oil for road paving projects and specialty low-sulfur turbine fuels for the exclusive use of Golden Valley and Copper Valley Electric Association. As previously testified to by DNR and DOG staff, and as explained in the best interest finding, this contract is good for the state in terms of its maximizing the revenues generated from Alaska's royalty oil share. It also benefits Alaska by helping to maintain the in-state petroleum refining industry and thus preserves competition within the state's fuel market. It is for these reasons that I encourage the committee to approve this RIK contract. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my statement. I appreciate this opportunity to address the committee and would be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. I don't see anyone else online for public testimony. With that, I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 239. Are there any questions or comments from committee members? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill number 239, version 32-GS2121/A, to be moved from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations.
Thank you, Senator. Any objections? Seeing no objections, Senate Bill 239, version A, passes from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations. Last today, we will quickly brief at ease. Last today, we'll take up Senate Bill 240. I'm going to give the department an opportunity to just make a few comments. We have been through the presentation. We understand the concept. Mr. Meza, Mr. Crowder, do you have any comments before we go to public testimony?
Thank you, Chair. I do not believe we have any further comments or statements at this time.
Thank you. For the public, it's just an identical bill, different content. So with that, we're going to move on to public testimony for Senate Bill 240. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone on the room who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 240? Seeing no one, is there anyone online who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 240? I see Mr. Casey Sullivan from Marathon Petroleum. Mr. Sullivan, please identify yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Honorable Chairman and committee members of the Senate Resources Committee. Just do a quick mic check. Can you hear me?
Just fine. Thank you.
Great. Hey, I know it's at the end of the day, and this has been a lot of information. I will keep it brief. We did submit this letter for the record, so you do have it with you. But, you know, it is our pleasure to share our overwhelming support for Senate Bill 240. The availability, the flexibility, and the stability that this contract offers will absolutely have a positive impact on our ability to optimize our ongoing operations at the Kenai Refinery. I think you're all aware the Kenai Refinery was the first refinery in the state of Alaska. It's been operating for over 50 years and provides, you know, the state of Alaska with the core supply of jet, diesel, gasoline, propane, and asphalt. You know, from Nikiski to North Pole. So we do that every day, and we're proud of what we do. And, you know, this legislation is really the result of a very long but ongoing a constructive dialogue and productive negotiations between the Department of Natural Resources and Marathon. We just want to say we very much appreciate the professional work by the members of the division at all stages of the process, and we're really confident that this contract for you does provide a positive shared value to all Alaskans. So with that, Mr. Chairman, you know, we do believe in Alaska's future. We're committed to continuing our longstanding legacy of safely and reliably producing quality fuels day in and day out for Alaskans. Thank you all for your attention here today, for your service to the great state, and we encourage your support of SB 240. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Any questions for Mr. Sullivan? Seeing none, is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 240? Seeing no one, I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 240. Are there any questions or comments from committee members? If not, I will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill number 240, version 32-GS2122/A, be moved from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, Senate Bill 240, Version A, passes from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations. Thank you, committee members, for being here. Please stick around to sign the paperwork for the bills removed from committee today. Thank you all who assisted, committee members, LAO support staff who helped with today's meeting, as well as pages. Our next regularly scheduled meeting will be this coming Monday, April 4th, where we plan to review Senate Bill 85, Senate Bill 227, and Senate Bill 228, pending scheduling with the Senate Secretary. This meeting is adjourned at 5:06 p.m.